You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The General by Christian Farias, with photos by Andre D. Wagner. One day before her Supreme Court debut as the next Solicitor General of the United States, Elizabeth Prelogar was walking around her Capitol Hill neighborhood with a doctor and a Rubik's Cube. She went trick-or-treating with her two young sons, as one does when Halloween is a big deal in the family. The Senate had just confirmed her on October 28, 2021, and Attorney General Merrick Garland swore her in the next day, with her boys and husband by her side, as the Justice Department's fourth highest-ranking official. It was a command performance that Mom had to be there, she once recalled. Yet on her mind that day, as she was going door to door, was the fate of abortion rights in Texas, which the state had all but nullified with a new law, SB 8, allowing private parties to sue neighbors, doctors, or anyone else they suspected of performing or assisting a person in obtaining an abortion. At the time, still a fundamentally protected right under the Constitution. SB 8 is a brazen attack on the coordinate branches of the federal government, she argued on November 1st. It's an attack on the authority of this court to say what the law is and to have that judgment respected across the 50 states. As much as she tried, General Prelogar, as the justices addressed her that morning, couldn't convince a majority to let the U.S. government intervene in court to protect Texans from a law that clearly violates this court's precedents. It was her first exposure during the Biden years as Solicitor General to what has been a coordinated, long-in-the-making assault on abortion rights at the federal level. The same five conservative justices who, in a parallel case, more or less allowed the biggest state in the South to ignore Roe v. Wade went all the way less than a year later in overruling it for the entire nation with Dobbs. There, too, Prelogar lost. As an advocate and a self-described incorrigible optimist, she takes those losses hard, as a human, too. It's hard as a human who cares about the issues and who recognizes that many of the cases that I'm litigating have profound effects on people throughout our nation, she told an audience earlier this year. In this new chaotic normal for reproductive freedoms, as well as for gun rights, the future of federal agencies, and other areas of the law that seem to be up for grabs, Prelogar, 44, has had to make sense of a confusing legal landscape. And she has had to be the face of a Democratic administration in front of the most conservative and unpopular Supreme Court in nearly a century, one remade by Donald Trump, beset by ethics scandals, and responsible for setting the American Project back several decades. In her Justice Department office in Washington, D.C., a vase holds the evidence of how busy the 48th Solicitor General of the United States has been. In it, a collection of quills, an old-time souvenir the Supreme Court gives every advocate who argues there, serves as a reminder of her nearly 4 years standing up for the government. Despite this visibility and all the attention and praise she gets from people who follow the Supreme Court closely, most Americans would be hard-pressed to name one Solicitor General, let alone explain what this government lawyer does. It may be the most low-key, influential job you've never heard of, tasked with defending the United States and its interest before the High Court, the only presidentially appointed officer required to be learned in the law. That qualification doesn't exist for the Attorney General or even the justices of the Supreme Court. Prelogar's tenure has been especially frenzied. In the term that recessed in July alone, by one count, she argued nearly 20% of all the cases in which the government was involved, the highest percentage for any Solicitor General in a quarter century or more. And of all the cases the court decided, her office participated in the lion's share of them. As Chief Justice John Roberts and his arch-conservative supermajority have asserted dominance and made it harder for Congress and the President to govern, Prelogar has been there all along, making sure the government, if it's going to lose, will at least lose well. Or wielding her oratory skills and legal argumentation to try to convince, at minimum, two members of Roberts's bloc to rule for her side, or at least rule in a way where the damage to our laws and institutions is manageable, or averted for a time. Because solicitors general tend to let their oral arguments and legal filings do the talking, Prelogar declined to speak on the record to Vanity Fair for this profile. Still, her voice comes through clearly in everything her office touches. In speeches she's given at law schools and legal conferences, and even articles she wrote or interviews she gave long before becoming the Justice Department's top Supreme Court lawyer. I connected with dozens of people who know her personally and professionally, whose recollections and insights reveal how this Idaho native with a sterling record, who once aspired to be a journalist and happens to be a Triple Crown beauty pageant winner, ascended to a perch once held by the likes of Thurgood Marshall, Robert Bork, and Elena Kagan. As the nation was reeling from Dobbs, back in her hometown of Boise a couple of summers ago, Prelogar was asked whether she feels a sense of futility in arguing before this Supreme Court. Although sometimes it might seem like the writing's on the wall, and that a particular outcome is preordained, there is always room to try to advocate effectively, she said, adding, I try never to lose hope, but rather to focus on the things that I can control, and on trying to present our case as effectively as I can. Before she packed her bags for Washington, Prelogar was thriving with her family in Idaho, or at least adapting to the surreal early stages of the pandemic. Prelogar, her husband, Brandon, and two sons had moved from D.C. to Boise to stay with her mother, Jeannie Barkas, a retired school teacher and someone who has been a constant at key moments of her life, according to friends, even though it was a temporary move. Idaho offered this magical space where the Prelogars could stay connected to family and friends. Jordan Heller, who has known her since their days at Boise High School, tells me. Elizabeth Barkas Prelogar was born Elizabeth Margaret Barkas at St. Luke's Hospital in Boise in 1980. She is the fourth child of the late Rudolph Rudy Barkas, an Idaho lawyer, and Jeannie, who worked as a special education teacher in the Boise School District for more than two decades. According to people who know the story, Prelogar was something of an accidental baby. After her brother Eric, who is 9 years older than her, was born, her mother experienced many miscarriages. The Barkases adopted their second child, Leah, in part because they weren't sure if they'd ever be able to conceive again after their second child, Joshua Daniel, died at birth in the 1970s. Prelogar has shared memories of how her mother once took her and her sister as young girls to watch their father in a big criminal trial, remembering being equally bored and fascinated by how the courtroom and its various actors interact. One anecdote about her father that she hasn't shared, and that in some ways presages her own future in law, is how he once served as Jeannie's defense attorney and took her case all the way to the Idaho Supreme Court and won. The story is a yarn, but suffice it to say, Rudy Barkas, before his daughter Elizabeth was born, convinced the state's highest court that his wife's misdemeanor conviction for driving with an expired registration cannot be sustained. In the 1970s, her father, a committed Democrat, went to work for Wayne Kidwell, at the time the newly elected Republican Attorney General of Idaho. Kidwell, who is now 86, shared fond memories of Lizzie, whom he recalls as a bright and curious child who would relish sitting on the lap of his wife Sherry as she played the piano. He and Barkas became good friends after he appointed him in 1975 to run the Attorney General Office's first ever Consumer Protection Division. "I needed someone who believed in it," he says. "I found numerous newspaper clippings of Barkas suing to end the price gouging of milk, warning Idahoans about the quality of coal, and taking a stand on the environmental impact of cloud seeding to address drought conditions." Rudy really enjoyed being a lawyer, and he really enjoyed his job as the head of consumer protection, Kidwell says, and I'm sure that must have rubbed off on his young daughter. Idaho is where a 12-year-old Elizabeth Barkas would get up at the crack of dawn to take a half-hour bus ride to Boise State University, where she took college-level courses while still a seventh grader, because her school could no longer meet her needs in English and math, according to a special education coordinator at Basin Elementary School in Idaho City. In high school, she contemplated a career in journalism while she wrote for her student and local papers. During her senior year, she was one of two Idaho students selected to go to White House as presidential scholar honorees of President Bill Clinton. Her high school teacher, Russ Heller, her friend Jordan's father, as it happens, accompanied her to D.C. for the occasion. He showed me a note that Lizzie wrote him before she left for Atlanta on a full scholarship to Emory. "I only hope the professors at Emory can live up to you," she wrote. As she excelled academically, she kept busy competing and winning the crowns of Miss Idaho Teen USA, 1998, and Miss Idaho USA, 2001. News stories from this period show a vibrant, outgoing, and undaunted Elizabeth Barkas, fully immersed in the world of pageantry, one where beauty and brains weren't mutually exclusive, and where stereotypes, at least when speaking to reporters, didn't hold her back. "The kind of pageant girl that people think of is one that I would argue doesn't exist anymore," she told the Idaho Statesman. Accompanying the article was a collage of images from her personal pageant collection, showing her beaming in an evening gown competition and posing with members of NSYNC and erstwhile beauty pageant impresario Donald Trump. In a sidebar, the 20-year-old listed her guilty pleasure, chocolate ice cream, favorite Boise activity, jogging on the greenbelt, and fantasy job, Supreme Court justice. Like a good journalist in training, Barkas wrote a first-person account of this grueling slice of her life in the Austin American Statesman, one of the papers she interned at while in college. In Behind the Beauty, she writes of how thrilling and unglamorous pageant life can be. The long hours of modeling and walking rehearsals, the cramped bus rides, the endless spotlight and freebies, the crises of confidence, and the emotional roller coaster in constantly comparing yourself to 50 accomplished, cheerful, gorgeous women. She recalled calling her mother crying one day because her strut wasn't the best. "Mom, I can't walk." People and friends familiar with this period of her life understand that participating in beauty contest was, in a way, one of a piece with her numerous awards, achievements, and drive to go above and beyond, as well as a way to help pay for school. Her parents had some savings for her to pursue higher education, but it wouldn't be enough to cover Harvard Law School, where she was admitted after finishing summa cum laude at Emory. She didn't go right away. She deferred three times. The first time, to spend a year at University of St. Andrews in Scotland on a full scholarship for a master's degree in creative writing. the second to spend a year in Russia studying media censorship on a Fulbright, where she met her future husband. And the third time to go for the Triple Crown in the 2004 Miss Idaho pageant, for which she spent the year promoting A Dad Just Like Mine, a self-published children's book that was inspired by her father, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's when she was very young and lived with it for decades. Then Representative C.L. Butch Otter of Idaho marked the occasion of this final run as Miss Idaho in the congressional record. Elizabeth's platform is understanding individuals with disabilities. And I am very proud of her continued commitment of community service for Idaho and across the globe, he said. In 2021, both of Idaho's Republican senators voted for her confirmation. In one Associated Press photo during the Miss America Boardwalk Parade in Atlantic City, Prologer appears to be having the time of her life, smiling widely as she waves to the crowd, dressed to the nines in a blue gown and an ornate headdress, all the while holding a pair of Spuddy Buddies, an Idaho potato mascot of sorts. Elaine Metlin, now a close friend who attended her wedding and has seen Prologer argue at the Supreme Court, recalled the magical summer when she hired her as a nanny. Right as she was preparing to go to Harvard, she had to Google her because she seemed too good to be true, and the thought of having a Miss America contestant as a sitter made her wary. She was stunned by the search results, and all her references checked out. Prologer's farewell to a life of pageantry, just as she was about to enter her career in law, seems like a lifetime ago, but appearing on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me last year, Prologer drew a connection between her time in beauty contest and as the top advocate for the U.S. government. If you want to look at a through line here, I like to go in front of judges, she said. Prologer's Idaho roots have been evident even in the rarefied environment of Supreme Court oral advocacy, where she has defended against all odds everything from pandemic-era measures and key environmental actions to affirmative action in higher education and Biden's student loan forgiveness program. In an exchange with Prologer in a complicated tax case last December, Justice Neil Gorsuch was trying to draw a distinction between two concepts when he mentioned the age-old dilemma on how to pronounce the word potato. Potato, potato, I sometimes wonder, he said. Prologer didn't miss a beat. I'm from Idaho, so I love that. You totally get that, Gorsuch shot back. She really did, as the Supreme Court ended up ruling for the United States. Harvard Law School changed the course of Prologer's life almost instantly. Once in Cambridge, she ditched journalism and dove headlong into the world of casebooks, moot courts, legal journals, and Socratic thinking. She was a rock star in then-Dean Elena Kagan's administrative law class, according to people familiar with this period. But oral advocacy is where she truly shone. She and her teammate Tahinder Singh were finalists in their school's storied Ames Moot Court competition, appearing before a bench that included the late Justice Antonin Scalia. In an earlier round before then-Judge Gorsuch, she was named best oralist. Her mother bought her the theory business suit she wore to the finals. Now, 17 years later, a solicitor general, it's her go-to attire whenever she argues at the Supreme Court. That was not enough. Prologer went on to compete in a National American Bar Association appellate advocacy competition, one of the largest and most competitive moot court tournaments in the country. This time, she and another teammate won the top title for the first time in Harvard's history. Singh, who became a dear friend and later officiated her wedding, recalled in an interview that besides her sharp writing and legal thinking, which many students at Harvard had, what made Prologer stand out was her almost limitless level of stamina. What really set her apart, more than anybody else, is she has a truly remarkable ability to just focus and work for extended periods of time, very, very efficiently, he told me. This streak of excellence earned her coveted one-year judicial clerkships in Washington, first with then-appeals judge Merrick Garland, and then with Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Kagan. Prelogger has spoken fondly of each of those experiences, how Garland would absorb in an hour what would take her weeks to research and write, how Ginsburg taught her that the law is not an abstraction, but impacts real humans, and how Kagan appreciated dissent when discussing the law with her clerks. Speaking with a number of her former co-clerks, I learned that Prelogger stood out in other ways, that she channeled Ginsburg's voice so well that the justice gave her more opinion assignments, and that early in her time with Kagan, who had just joined the Supreme Court after her term as President Barack Obama's first Solicitor General, Prelogger learned she was pregnant with her first child. The baby was due in April, right as things get really busy at the court. After the baby was born, she went right back to work, and she made it work. For a time, a nursery was set up in an upstairs section of the court, and her mother was in town to help. It was clear then how extraordinary she was. Pamela Bookman, a Ginsburg co-clerk and a law professor at Fordham University, told me. But I think it has been made even more clear since then. By then, working in the office of the Solicitor General was already in her sights. Neil Katyal, an acting Solicitor General and former deputy to Kagan early in the Obama administration, was among the talented lawyers who wowed her from the Supreme Court lectern. The world of Supreme Court advocacy is small and insular, and so when Katyal returned to private practice, his firm snapped up Prelogger. Elizabeth is already being asked for by name by my biggest clients, Katyal told the Wall Street Journal in 2012. A typical six-figure sign-on bonus that year was larger than a Supreme Court justice's salary. But her real goal was becoming an assistant solicitor general, one of 16 career positions that are among the hardest to get in the Justice Department because spots rarely open up. But as soon as one did in the summer of 2014, she applied. Michael Dreeben, a longtime deputy solicitor general who has argued more than 100 cases before the Supreme Court and was tapped as a counselor to special counsel Jack Smith, was among the first to zero in on Prelogger's long-term goals. During a talk at Duke last year, she recounted that in one of the interview rounds, Dreeben asked her, if you could have any job in the law, what would it be? She replied, Solicitor General. The second part of that exchange, according to people familiar with it, was classic Dreeben, who deadpanned. That's one of two correct answers. Prelogger appearing relieved, but intrigued. She went in cold into the interview. Ask him what the other one was. Supreme Court Justice, he said. As an assistant, the cases she handled herself, seven in all, were not the headline-grabbing kind. Those belonged to her boss or his deputies. Yet she did grab headlines in 2017 when Robert Mueller selected Dreeben, at the time the Justice Department's leading criminal law expert, to join his special counsel team, which was investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election. Dreeben assembled his own team, focused on legal issues related to the investigation, and Prelogger was among those he handpicked to join him. Andrew Weissman, a former top DOJ prosecutor who wrote a book about the investigation, told me of the embarrassment of riches that it was to have people like Prelogger help argue one of his cases against former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort. She also worked on key sections of the Mueller report. The legal team was in charge of the overall writing, the structure, hammering out the law, and making sure it all sounded like one voice, Weissman said. In self-deprecating fashion, Prelogger has recalled feeling like a fish out of water, sitting at a lunch table full of hardened prosecutors, as they shared war stories of flipping difficult witnesses. I'm just sitting there, feeling this tremendous sense of, like, who does not belong at this table, she has said. I can't flip my kids and get them to cooperate with me. Next photo, letter of the law. Prelogger sifting through files in her office at the Department of Justice. Once the investigation wrapped, and Prelogger briefly returned to OSG, as the office is known at the Justice Department, Andrew Goldstein, another Mueller prosecutor, helped to recruit her to Cooley, a Palo Alto, California-based law firm that represents the likes of Meta and OpenAI. Michael Attanasio, the chair of the firm's litigation department, told me that Prelogger was the ultimate draft pick to help build a new Supreme Court practice at Cooley, and the door would be wide open should she wish to return. We'd take the door off the hinges, he told me. At Cooley, Prelogger took on high-impact pro bono work, including a challenge to the Trump administration's mad dash to carry out a string of federal executions and breaking legal ground for LGBTQ+ rights in her home state of Idaho. This was the first case of its kind, Chase Strangio, one of the ACLU lawyers who worked with Prelogger on the challenge to an Idaho ban on transgender athletes in school sports, tells me. Yet her brief stint at Cooley coincided with Biden's election, and returning to government held strong appeal. Like prior solicitors general, Prelogger had the prestigious legal credentials, including her clerkship with the soon-to-be attorney general. Unlike prior solicitors general, she was not exactly a creature of Washington politics. Nor did she possess the kind of background, like work in the White House or other high-profile political appointments, to serve as her calling card. Donald Verrilli, who served as Obama's second solicitor general and hired her in 2014, is said to have inspired her to work for the new administration. Some six-plus years later, according to people familiar with this period, Prelogger threw her hat in the ring and submitted her resume to the Biden-Harris transition team, hoping for the best. She didn't hear back from the transition team until before the holidays, when a person interviewed her for possible service. With less than a week before the start of the new administration, Prelogger was offered the job of Principal Deputy Solicitor General. A source familiar with the DOJ transition told me that a number of people who are extraordinarily well-respected were pushing for Elizabeth to land in this position on day one of the Biden years. As Prelogger was divesting from all her cases and preparing to fly back to Washington to start her biggest job yet, Strangio was among those she called to break the news. He recalls a previous conversation in which she said, "There's only one or two jobs in government that I would leave for. Defending the government's interest in the Supreme Court was one of them." On the first day of the Biden presidency, before she had fully moved into her office at the Justice Department, Prelogger received an urgent call from one of her deputies. He told her that a federal agency was interested in greenlighting an important action at the start of the new administration. There was one wrinkle. The proposed action could have ramifications for a pending Supreme Court matter, one in which the Office of the Solicitor General had already staked out a position. The deputy's advice to his new boss, call the acting general counsel for the agency and advise that they not take the action. I hung up the phone with him and admittedly had a little bit of a freak-out moment, Prelogger recalled during a lecture in Idaho. Was I really going to call the general counsel of an agency on my first day on the job and urge them not to take a significant federal action because of its possible impact on a pending Supreme Court case? Yes, indeed. That's exactly what she did. She took a few deep breaths, read all the relevant materials, wrapped her head around the problem, consulted with her deputy, and then called the agency counsel, who agreed with her solution. Delay the action until they could figure out how to implement it without messing up the pending litigation. Crisis averted. The principal deputy solicitor general serves at the pleasure of the president and can fill in as acting Solicitor General in the event of a vacancy or if the Solicitor General is recused for any reason. That was Prelogar's role on January 20th, 2021, the day she had to put out a small fire between her office and another agency. According to people familiar with this early tenure, she was happy to remain in this acting role until the new administration put forth a name. It never crossed her mind at the time that she'd be the nominee one day. As twists of fate go, Prelogar was not initially the Biden administration's top choice for the nomination. Leandra Kruger, a California Supreme Court justice who served as assistant and acting principal deputy solicitor general during the Obama years, was said to be a candidate. But she reportedly declined the job more than once. Two federal appeals judges, Sri Srinivasan and Diane Wood, and Washington litigators Andrew Pincus and David Frederick were also floated as possible candidates. For 9 months, the Biden Justice Department did not have a Senate-confirmed Solicitor General. One of the longest stretches in modern history, a new administration has gone without one. A White House official told me in an email that Dana Remus, Biden's first White House counsel, and her deputy, Stuart Delery, were two of Prelogar's biggest backers for the job besides the president, and that they were focused on getting hundreds of other nominees confirmed at the DOJ and elsewhere. Our goal was to make sure Prelogar was officially confirmed before the Supreme Court term started, and she was, the official said. The term had started weeks earlier. The position of Solicitor General is as old as the Justice Department itself, created after the Civil War to bring order and stability to how the federal government litigates cases, especially those enforcing black civil rights throughout the United States. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall often described his job as Solicitor General as the best he'd ever had. Heller, Prelogar's high school friend, echoed Marshall's sentiment. My sense is that this is as hard as she's ever worked, and it's the best job she's ever had, she tells me. Prelogar, in public remarks, has likened her role to that of a traffic cop, trying to get all the pieces of the federal government moving in the same direction at the same time. Her office signs off on every appeal where the government loses a case in the lower courts. That prerogative runs from the technical and the mundane to the controversial, like appealing the Florida judge's dismissal of Jack Smith's prosecution of Trump over his retention of classified documents. Peter Carr, Smith's spokesperson, confirmed the Solicitor General greenlit that appeal. Prelogar was also present in the courtroom when the Trump immunity case was argued, and Smith's counselor, Michael Dreeben, told the justices that the Solicitor General of the United States had been consulted on the work of the special counsel. It also falls to Prelogar to notify Congress when the government won't be appealing a major adverse ruling, which she did in June when she sent a letter to House Speaker Mike Johnson saying that the department wouldn't appeal a Trump-appointed judge's ruling undermining the little-known Minority Business Development Agency. The agency, which dates back to the Nixon years, could continue its mission, Prelogar reasoned, and the ruling was narrow enough that it wasn't in the best interest of the United States to seek further review. As Seth Waxman, one of her predecessors, once said, on appeal, things can always get worse. With the current Supreme Court, that's an understatement. In late June, Prelogar and a group of lawyers from her office in Washington boarded a pair of vans at the Justice Department and took a ride to the Supreme Court, a minutes-long drive toward the east end of Capitol Hill. By long-standing tradition, on days the justices are expected to issue decisions, the Solicitor General and her team attend the day's session and get the best seats in the House. The 8 chairs at counsel table, only a few feet from the bench where the 9 justices preside. on this particular day, this section of the courtroom, reserved for members of the Supreme Court bar, sat almost empty. The Supreme Court doesn't announce which opinions are due on any given day, and like any other court watcher, Prelogar was expecting any of the still outstanding decisions of the term, a number of which would once again upend American law and society, disturbing decades' worth of precedent, governance, and people's settled expectations. At the top of the list was a landmark where the six conservatives, led by Roberts, ignored her calls to avoid an unwarranted shock to the legal system by overruling the foundational Chevron doctrine, which for generations had guided how Congress delegated power to federal agencies to make rules to safeguard workers, our health, the environment, financial institutions, and other areas of American life. And despite her Herculean efforts, she could not convince a majority, again led by Roberts, to sustain a charge against a Capitol rioter federal prosecutors had accused of obstructing the joint session of Congress on January 6th. Yet on Prelogar's mind, the morning of June 27th, just one day before that pair of stinging losses, one case stood out, a relatively small but consequential dispute that could mean life, death, or near certain harm to the health of pregnant patients in her home state of Idaho. She had good reason to be thinking about it. A day earlier, the Supreme Court accidentally posted the outcome of the ruling to its website before quickly taking it down. Moyle v. United States, which Prelogar argued in April, is the inevitable fallout of the fall of Roe v. Wade in 2022, one of the many abortion-related controversies that have arrived and are expected to arrive before the same Supreme Court that decreed that the issue of when or whether someone may terminate their pregnancy belong to people and their elected representatives, not federal judges. In the wake of Dobbs, the Justice Department formed a task force charged with protecting reproductive rights in those discrete areas where the federal government still can. Vanita Gupta, who led the task force until she left the department in February, tells me that Prelogar plays a key role in those discussions and is unafraid to speak truth around the table, especially when it comes to litigation and appellate strategy, or when her analysis may differ from colleagues. Yet she added that Prelogar is so down to earth and otherwise brilliant that her insights, even on finer points of law, are well received. She has a lot of fanboys and fangirls in the department, Gupta adds. The Attorney General is one of them. She is one of the most exceptional legal minds in this country, and I think all of us should be grateful to have her representing us, Garland said during a recent Idaho event with Prelogar by his side. It is through this task force that the Justice Department has been defending the Food and Drug Administration's approval of the abortion drug mifepristone and efforts to make it more accessible. Despite a track record of safety and effectiveness, the drug has been under siege by anti-abortion groups. Likewise, shortly after Dobbs, the department sued the state of Idaho under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, which, the government argued, protects pregnant patients' access to critical stabilizing care up to and including an abortion, even in states with strict anti-abortion laws. As expected, both issues made their way to the Supreme Court, and in both, the Solicitor General's advocacy made a difference. Jessica Huber, a friend of Prelogar who has known her since their early days in Washington, tells me that on the day she argued the mifepristone case, Prelogar volunteered to pick her kids up from soccer practice. She's a full human outside of that world, says Huber. Another friend had a different take. Elizabeth makes what she does look pretty easy because she doesn't melt down, but she is juggling a load that would cause most people to melt down, seeing her close friend from law school tells me. I think for her to maintain her life and her family and do her job taxes even her superhuman level of stamina sometimes. Then he adds, what people ought to know is just how much she shoulders by herself. It's kind of crazy. Prelogger's ability to remain composed under the glare of the likes of Justice Samuel Alito is what has gained her so many admirers. An extended exchange she had with him during the Emtala argument went viral on X, in part because one could sense her infinite patience wearing thin. In so many words, Alito suggested that the phrase unborn child in a different section of the law trumped the need to stabilize the health of pregnant women at risk. That seemed to set her off, and over his attempts to interrupt her, she didn't let him. I think the premise of the question would be that the state of Idaho can declare that she cannot get the stabilizing treatment even if she's about to die. That is their theory of this case and this statute, and it's wrong. By happenstance, the Emtala case touches on a number of strands of Prelogger's personal life. St. Luke's, the health system at the center of the case, has had to airlift pregnant patients out of the state as a result of Idaho's extreme abortion ban. She was born there and spent a good portion of her teenage years at its main hospital as a young volunteer. And her mother's own experiences with difficult pregnancies and the life-altering risk inherent to them underscores how personal standing up for those patients must have felt. We were very fortunate to have her in her position at this point in time to make those arguments, and couldn't be prouder as an Idahoan to be in that position today, Peg Doherty, a deputy general counsel at St. Luke's Health System, says a Prelogger at a briefing on the day the case was decided. With an election around the corner, no one knows what the future holds for the Solicitor General and the Justice Department's litigating positions in this and many other areas. On this score, the Biden administration and what remains of our constitutional order face an uncertain future. Case in point, on the day Prelogger attended the court session to learn of the ruling in Moyle v. United States, as the Emtala case is known, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson warned in open court that the outcome only offered a temporary reprieve. Today's decision is not a victory for pregnant patients in Idaho, Jackson said. It is delay. While this court dawdles and the country waits, pregnant people experiencing emergency medical conditions remain in a precarious position. This court had a chance to bring clarity and certainty to this tragic situation, and we have squandered it. Like Prelogger, Wayne Kidwell, the old family friend who hired her father to work in government, has experienced the changing world of law and politics, including as a Justice Department official during the Reagan Revolution and a justice on the highest court in Idaho. He thinks we haven't yet seen all that Prelogger can shoulder. I hope that I can live long enough that I can see her nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Stanley Tucci, the actor and author of What I Ate in 1 Year, On Face Cream, Harry Styles, and Why Temperance is Overrated. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A meal al fresco with people I love. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I would never presume to identify myself with any historical figure. Okay, Michelangelo. I could only ever hope to be like that person. What do you dislike most about your appearance? How much time do you have? In short, I would like to be younger, taller, and have my hair back. What is your greatest extravagance? Face cream. I love La Mer. Which living person do you most admire? President Zelensky. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Cruelty. I don't see the point. What is your greatest fear? Losing one of my children, as there is no greater loss. What is your favorite journey? To the River Cafe. I love to walk to that restaurant along the Thames any time of year in any weather. It is London at its best. On what occasion do you lie? To make a child feel secure. Which living person do you most despise? Trump. Need I say more? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? My instinct tells me my wife and my business partner, Lottie, always laugh when I say it. Not sure why. Seems perfectly reasonable. What is your greatest regret? Not being able to save my late wife, and not being the best I can be at all times. What or who was the greatest love of your life? My children? Art? Food? Which talent would you most like to have? To be able to play the piano like Diana Krall and sing like Harry Styles. What is your current state of mind? Occluded and exhausted from working too much. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be more patient. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I would make my parents younger. I want us all to have many more years with them. What do you consider your greatest achievement? That I've taught my children right from wrong, and that my work seems to have made a lot of people happy. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A jazz musician or a sculptor? Making art is time well spent. Where would you like to live? The Alps, because they never change but are different every day. What is your favorite occupation? I've pretended to have many occupations, and hopefully I will pretend to have many more. What are your favorite names? Alba, Rose, Nina, Oliver, Niccolo, Emilia, Isabel, Camilla, Matteo, Felicity, Kate. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Captain America. What do you most value in your friends? Kindness and humor. Who are your favorite writers? Philip Roth, Dorothy Parker, John Fosse, Robert Harris, Claire Keegan, S.J. Perelman. How would you like to die? Quickly, quietly in my sleep, after a great meal with friends and family. Who are your heroes in real life? My parents, people who run NGOs, single mothers. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Temperance. Just enjoy good food and drink in moderation. Life is meant to be tasted. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Stanley Tucci. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.